Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Wei Spur Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
From scienceblog.com, scientists have discovered that cuttlefish can talk with their arms.
Do they have arms?
Tentacles.
Yeah, I guess we should have talk and arms in air quotes.
Right,
maybe.
Okay.
But they've named these gestures arm wave signs. And yeah, that whole thing is in quotes there. And they appear to serve a communication system between cuttlefish. You can read the full study in BioRxiv, and it reveals that these underwater signals can not only be perceived visually, but also through water vibrations, which effectively creates a multi-sensory conversation.
I mean, yeah, it would be like if I talked to you by blowing at different pressures in your face. Like,
oh, I'm sorry. Are you not already doing that when you talk to me in person?
I am loud. It's true.
Well, it's not you. It's that all people, when they are talking, and you're feeling vibrations, too.
Right.
In fact, sound is vibration. Right?
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
So the research team led by Sophie Cohen and Peter Neri documented these movements over months of observation, and they were able to identify four distinct gestures. There was up, side, roll, and crown. And so each movement involves different arm positions and undulating motions, often combined with changes on the cuttlefish's skin, like color changes.
Mm.
So what they did is use specially designed playback experiments. They recorded the mechanical waves produced by these arm movements and played them back. These cuttlefish were more responsive to the original recordings compared to versions that were backwards or scrambled, suggesting this might actually be detecting meaningful information in the water movements alone.
Mm.
Now, the exact meaning behind these arm signs, yeah, we really don't know. The researchers observed them in various contexts, so it suggests the signs might serve multiple purposes depending on the context or situation, which, yeah, language, right?
I mean, they could all just be political slogans, too. Like, you don't know.
Right, or I say one of them's got to be a stand-up comedian.
Knock, 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 knock. Just wandering around waiting for somebody to knock back. So looking ahead, the research team hopes to explore how this discovery might provide insights into communication between vastly different animal species, which could open new pathways for understanding how diverse creatures interact with their environment. My guess is that the cephalopods are going to be like, it's really dirty down here. Can you stop dumping your trash?
Yeah. I mean, we're basically very close to having a puppet that you can just sort of shove your hand under the water and wiggle and actually communicate back and forth with them.
But like, I'm just imagining, you guys remember Arrival?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were like giant cephalopod creatures.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And to your point, we named them Abbott and Costello in that story, as I recall.
Who is on first? Okay. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from BBC.com. It's titled, Visit the Arctic Vault Holding Backups of Great Works.
Mm.
So, high above the Arctic Circle, the archipelago of Svalbard lies halfway between mainland Norway and the North Pole. It's home to hundreds of polar bears and a couple sparse settlements. One of those is Longyearbyen, the world's northernmost town, and just outside the settlement, in a decommissioned coal mine, is the Arctic World Archive, or AWA, an underground vault for data. Customers pay to have their data stored on film and kept in the vault for potentially hundreds of years. Inside the vault stands a shipping container stacked with silver packets, each containing reels of film on which the data is stored. Founder Rune Bjerkstrand says it's anything from digitized art pieces, literature, music, motion picture, you name it. Since the archive's launch 8 years ago, more than 100 deposits have been made by institutions, companies, and individuals from 30-plus countries. Among the many digitized artifacts are 3D scans and models of the Taj Mahal, tranches of ancient manuscripts from the Vatican Library, satellite observations of Earth from space, and Norway's treasured painting, The Scream, by Edvard Munch.
And a ridiculous amount of porn.
Probably.
You gotta save what's important. I mean, come on.
The AWA is a commercial operation and relies on technology provided by Norwegian data preservation company Pickle, which Mr. Bjorkstrand also heads. It was inspired by the Global Seed Vault, a seed bank that's located only a few hundred meters away where crops can be recovered after natural or man-made disasters.
This is going to be like Norway's main industry at this point is just vaults with stuff in them.
I mean, worked for the Swiss, right?
Oh, yeah. No. Most of that was Nazi stuff.
You know, it's about the structure, not the content, right?
Right.
At least in this case. So today there are lots of risks to information and data, he says. There is terrorism, war, cyber hackers. He says it's far away from everything, far away from wars, crisis, terrorism, disasters. What could be safer? Should global warming cause the thick Arctic permafrost to thaw, the vault is still robust enough to preserve its contents. At the back of the chamber, another large metal box contains GitHub's code vault. The software developer has archived hundreds of reels of open source code here, which are the building blocks underpinning computer operating systems, software, websites, and apps. GitHub's chief operating officer, Kyle Daigle, told the BBC, "It's incredibly important for humanity to secure the future of software." His firm has explored a variety of long-term storage solutions, and there are challenges. He says, "Some of our existing mechanisms can be stored for a very long time, but you need technology to read them." At Pickle's headquarters, data files are encoded onto photosensitive film. Senior product developer Alexei Mantsev explains, "Data is a sequence of bits and bytes. We convert the sequence of the bits which come from our client's data into images. Every image or frame is about 8 million pixels. Once these images are exposed and developed, the processed film appears gray, but viewed more closely, it's similar to a mass of tiny QR codes."
Like, what was that, microfiche? But for
yeah.
QR codes?
Yeah,
right, which is the only thing you can heist, is a microfiche.
Yeah, it is kind of wild that they're taking digital software and encoding it in analog. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if there's ever an apocalypse and we need to rebuild society, it'll be a race for Svalbard, I guess.
Well, and he was being all like, "There's no terrorism, no war." I'm like, not yet. You've just put a lot of valuable material in there, guy.
Yeah, like you have caused the cause of this future prophecy. So one key question arising with long-term storage methods is whether people will understand what has been preserved and how to recover it centuries into the future. That's a scenario Pickle has also thought about, and so a guide that can be magnified and read optically is printed onto the film as well. Every day, more data is being used and generated than ever before, but experts have long warned of a potential digital dark age as technological advances render previous software and hardware obsolete. That could mean the files and formats we use now face a similar fate to the floppy disks and DVD drives of the past. Cassettes of magnetic tape known as LTO or linear tape open are the most common form, but newer innovations promise to revolutionize how we preserve information. For example, Microsoft's Project Silica has developed 2 millimeter thick panes of glass onto which chunks of data is transferred by powerful lasers. Meanwhile, a team of scientists from the University of Southampton have created a so-called 5D memory crystal, which has saved a record of the human genome.
A what now?
Yeah. I don't know how that works, but they talk about it. And
so it must be true.
Yeah, you're going through time and through another thing, apparently, some sort of dimension. So that's also been placed in the Memory of Mankind repository, another vault safeguarding historic documents hidden in a salt mine in Austria. The Arctic World Archive receives deposits 3 times a year, and as the BBC visited, recordings of endangered languages and the manuscripts of the composer Chopin were among the latest reels placed in the vault. Photographer Christian Clowers, who's been documenting South Pacific islands threatened by sea level rise, was also adding his work. Archivist Joanne Shortland, head of heritage collections at the Jaguar Daimler Heritage Trust, said after depositing records, "It was really humbling and surreal." And she was depositing engineers' drawings and photographs of historic car models. She says, "I have all these formats that are becoming obsolete. The digital world has so many problems."
Yeah. I mean, it kind of feels like it always comes down to it's not the format, it's whether a person cares. Because if there's someone who says this is important, it must be saved, whether it's a clay tablet or a floppy disk that no one's ever going to be able to read, it's about getting people to care.
Yeah.
Right. How much does it cost? And can I put my family pictures in there? Like, I'm really important.
Yeah, you should be able to go in there and put stuff in. I want to go.
Yeah, just do a big caravan, show up, be like, hey, we have stuff to store too.
That's right. All of the pictures that your children drew in preschool and kindergarten, gather them up. We know where they go now.
But this is how future societies decide that I was really important in my era because I was the only person whose family photos were saved. I must have been like a god. Like,
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from neuroscience.news.com, and I know many of us suffer with this. Why noisy rooms are harder for some brains to handle?
I guess it's all of us.
But especially as we age, some people find it harder to understand speech in noisy environments. So previous research has separately established connections between hearing difficulties and dementia, as well as insula abnormalities and cognitive decline. So the insulae are two complicated structures that interact with the brain's frontal lobes. The frontal lobe is responsible, if you don't know, for higher level cognitive function, and the insulae integrate sensory, emotional, and cognitive information. The study involved 40 men and women ages 20 to 80. They underwent hearing tests first to determine who had difficulty hearing speech in noisy environments. They then underwent MRI tests of their brains at rest. Because they've done lots of task-based studies that reveal what parts of the brain activate during specific activities. These researchers wanted to study how speech and noise might affect the brain at baseline. So according to David S. Wack, first author and associate professor of radiology, resting state MRI reveals functional connections, showing how different brain regions work together even when not actively engaged in a task. The study found that the left insula showed stronger connectivity with auditory regions in people who struggle with speech and noise, suggesting a permanent rewiring of brain networks that persist even when they're not actively listening to challenging speech. Wack explains, your brain is always doing something. And when you have hearing loss, you are recruiting other areas of the brain to do more processing in order to decode what's going on.
Okay.
What's interesting is that we found the insula working harder when the brain was supposedly at rest. It's not that hearing loss causes dementia, but if we could find a way to preserve the fidelity of the signal coming in, then the brain wouldn't have to start compensating for hearing loss. But then there were some unexpected findings, as there usually are with the human brain. We had a subject who had a relatively poor hearing for pure tones, but who achieved the highest score for speech and noise in one ear. It turned out this person worked in an environment with high background noise. So this suggests that people don't have to just accept poor performance in noisy backgrounds. It shows you might be able to practice your way out of it. Maybe. Or that person was unique.
Right, exactly. He's an N of one. No, I thought it was more talking about in the beginning the idea of like being overwhelmed or distracted by noise.
I think those are two separate things.
Yeah, because I know people who are like, oh, I have to go write in a coffee shop. I'm like, that's the worst possible place for me. It's too distracting. I have to have silence to think or do anything, especially the older I get. But I don't know how hard it is for me to understand other people in public because I don't go in public. So,
yeah, usually I like to close with some good news, but I don't have one on this one. It just seems like that's it. Yeah.
Get your hearing checked, folks. That's the takeaway.
Fair enough.
Next link.
All right. This next one is a video from Wired, and it's called Cheating Expert Answers Casino Cheating Questions. So, you know, it's pretty much what it says on the tin. He goes through a bunch of different topics where he basically teaches you how to cheat, but then also explains how the casinos prevent you from doing it. So the whole thing's a wash, but it's pretty interesting. And part of this guy's expertise is he's worked in casino security for a long time. So the first question he answers is, do the casinos themselves ever cheat?
Ooh.
And the answer is, yeah, they definitely used to.
Oh, used to.
Used to. He put in air quotes.
I mean, technically right now he works for a casino, so he's not going to say yes, but he's very enthusiastic about, oh, they really very much did in the 60s and 70s.
Wow.
He gives the example of a blackjack deck and shows some really specific ways you can stack the order of the deck to where even if you don't know how many people are playing at the table or whether they're going to choose to hit or not, everyone somehow still ends up with a losing hand except the dealer. But he says that was all in the past when, quote, the mob ran things. And nowadays they really don't cheat, he says, because they don't have to. They just keep math on their side and that guarantees they're going to do just fine. But what about individual dealers cheating? He says, absolutely, that can happen even today, generally in a setup where the dealer and a particular player are working together, not against you, but to take money from the casino. And that really just boils down to the dealer giving the player more chips than they're supposed to have, either by slipping an extra one in the stack when they pay out, or even using what's called a chip cup, which is a hollow cylinder that looks like a stack of a certain denomination, but inside is actually a stack of much more valuable chips. So, yeah, they look like they're paying out the correct amount, but actually they're just passing expensive chips over to the player so they can walk out with them. And, you know, there are some classic sleight of hand tricks like dealing seconds, which looks like a normal deal but leaves the top card on the deck until you choose who you want to give it to. But he says with modern dealing machines, those methods are much harder than they used to be. Basically, nobody's really dealing by hand anymore, at least in a professional setting. But he does show you how to do it and is like, you need to watch out. If this is not in a casino, you can get scammed. So then we come to loaded dice, which both players or crooked casinos could potentially use to their advantage. And there's a couple of different ways you can load the dice, some of which are more reliable than others. You can, for example, very subtly change the weight distribution inside the dice so that they're more likely, but not guaranteed, to land with the heavier side down. And the way casinos check for this is with a neat little device he shows us called a balancer. It basically looks like a tiny little vice grip. And when you pinch two opposite corners of the cube between it, you can spin it freely, kind of like a fidget spinner. And when you do that, a balanced die will just spin, but an imbalanced one kind of flails around all wonky. It's really immediately obvious that it's a weighted die. And the balancer is small enough for anyone on the casino floor to just carry one in their pocket. So they can spot check any dice at any point if they're feeling suspicious. So for that kind of risk to the cheater, this guy says most cheaters prefer a pair of dice that are weighted normally, but actually have the wrong dots printed on them. Like they'll have two sides with four dots printed and no sides with one dot. And the trick with those is you have to be able to swap them in for a key roll that you want to win and then get them back off the table and put the original dice back before the dealer notices. And that's another sleight of hand thing that he claims is actually harder than most card tricks because most people's hands just aren't meaty enough to reliably pair a palm of dice.
But he's in the land of magicians.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, he can do it. He basically does a really good job and then goes, this is really hard. So to a certain degree, he's just bragging.
Yep. Right.
He also notes that dice tables at the casinos all have a little ring of mirror running around the inside edge because that allows the dealer to see five out of the six sides every time the dice land and kind of re-verify on every roll that the dots are where they're supposed to be. Another way to manipulate the dice is with magnets, and that again gets you more in the realm of being statistically likely but not guaranteed to land on a certain side, but it has the advantage of being able to be used or not at your discretion while keeping the same set of dice on the table at all times. And he tells a couple of wild stories here about people hiding their magnets in things like wheelchairs, and even one guy who had the magnets surgically implanted into his fingers and kept them there for 40 years. Which,
wow.
Sadly, my first thought was like, that could actually be useful for other things. Like if I'm repairing a computer, right, I don't want to lose all the tiny little screws.
Right. Just stick my finger down there.
Exactly. It would be super useful. Yeah. And apparently the guy said he had them taken out only because he had to fly and he thought that they would be discovered like in the X-ray machine and it, you know, he'd be arrested for 40 years of cheating. But anyway, next we come to everyone's favorite example, counting cards. And it should be noted that counting cards is not technically cheating and is not illegal, but the casino does have the right to refuse service to anyone, and they will definitely ban you if they think you're counting cards. But the interesting thing here that I didn't realize is that I thought the only way to count cards was Rain Man style, just memorize every card that's come through. But actually, there is a simpler way to do it that I think most people could probably keep up with. All you have to do is mentally assign low-value cards a score of +1 and high-value cards a score of -1 and keep a running total in your head as the cards pass by. So it ends up working out like a coin flip in the sense that on average, you're going to hover back and forth around zero. But if at any point you get to a score in your mind of two or higher, that means more low cards have come through, not as many high cards have come through as you would expect, and therefore you should bet because you're more likely to see those high cards finally coming out of what remains. And then he goes into the concept of how realistic some of these movies like Ocean's 11 are. And he says, honestly, the truth is, yeah, it's expensive and there are risks, but you can absolutely pull off a complicated heist with amazing costumes and props. And he gives a real example of something that happened in Macau, where the gambling is even bigger than Vegas, apparently. And the story is that a high roller flew in. He was picked up and taken by a limo to the casino. Management was outside to meet him. They escorted him to their special VIP gambling suite on the 23rd floor. He played a bunch of hands, end up losing about $25 million. And when he was downstairs later, he mentioned to the staff, you know, like, oh, man, I lost $25 million in your private room upstairs. And they were like, we don't have a private room upstairs.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it turned out these scammers had just rented a normal suite, cleared out all the furniture, set up their own tables. Everything was counterfeited to look exactly like it did downstairs. They had a dozen fake staff members all dressed in the right uniforms.
Oh.
And at the end of the day, they couldn't catch these guys because all they had was footage from the hallway because the bedrooms are the one place the hotel can't put cameras. And then he goes into some methods for marking cards where you can hide a tiny little ink pot in the center of a chip or even shave down the long sides of the cards with a little emery board so they have this incredibly subtle hourglass shape. And he shows you the results on the video. And unless you're trained to look for it, you cannot see it. But he's a professional, so he's like, there's the four, there's the ace. I can see these a mile off.
Wow.
He also talks about special glasses that are like red filtering so you can see shapes that are printed on the back of a deck that no one else can. But he notes that in real life, if you're going to do that, you actually get special contacts to wear because everyone knows what the glasses look like. And I know it feels like I've listed 100 things, but I haven't covered even half of what he talks about.
Wow.
He goes into counterfeiting chips and card counting computers you can hide in your shoes and even using AI glasses to predict where a roulette ball is going to land based on its current bounce and trajectory, like mid-roll. So there's so much stuff in this video. It's honestly one of my favorites.
Does he talk about coolers at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Several times.
Yeah, I'm a cooler. I am technically a cooler. My brother did not believe me. I was just in Vegas. I was like, I promise you, if I'm standing next to you, you will not win.
You bad luck Bradley, is what you're saying.
Yep. By the end, it was kind of like, all right, get away.
Yeah, I've heard people claim the opposite, that there is such a thing as beginner's luck as well. That like you walk in carefree and you believe you're going to win and you will more likely win. I don't think anybody should stake their life savings on this, but, you know, go learn how to cheat. It's amazing because then maybe you aren't losing your money.
There you go.
Next link.
Next link. All right. From noridge.com, magic mushrooms could reduce depression and motor issues in Parkinson's.
Oh,
wow.
Right? Now, it's already being studied for its potential to relieve depression and anxiety, which we've covered before on the podcast, but this is the first time it's been tested in patients with a neurodegenerative disease like Parkinson's. And the results surprised researchers by showing not just safety, but also meaningful improvements in mood, memory, and movement. So in this small pilot study, they had 12 people with mild to moderate Parkinson's. They were given two doses of psilocybin. So they had a small 10 milligram dose first, and then 2 weeks later, they had a higher 25 milligram dose. And these are still kind of microdosing amounts, so keep that in mind. Along with the drug, they also received psychotherapy before and after each treatment to support emotional experience and safety. So some participants had temporary side effects like nausea, anxiety, or a little bit of elevated blood pressure. None of the effects were serious or required medical help. The real surprise came later. And this is when the participants returned for follow-ups 1 week, 1 month, and 3 months after their treatments. They reported feeling significantly better, not just in terms of mood, but also in how clearly they could think and how well they could move. The study's first author, Ellen Bradley, explained that these emotional symptoms are often overlooked, but they're also a strong predictor of how much Parkinson's will affect a person's daily life. So helping people feel better emotionally might actually help slow down their physical decline as well. Now, because these results were so encouraging, the team's already working on a larger follow-up study. They're going to have the next trial include 100 people. It will also include brain imaging and other tools to study how psilocybin affects brain inflammation and the rebuilding of brain circuits.
They just did a story about that with PTSD on NPR not too long ago. And the part that made me nearly do a spit take was when they talked to our former governor, Rick Perry. And Rick was friends with this guy. And he said, "Now I'm, you know, never going to make drugs legal, but you'd have to be really cruel to make this illegal."
Well, if only he were gifted with some self-awareness, then he wouldn't be a politician, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes from Discover Magazine. It's titled, "Crime Scene Investigators Could Soon Identify a Suspect's Face from DNA."
What?
Oh, yeah. Pretty wild, right?
At least they can say they do this, but can they really?
You just got to grow a clone really, really fast.
Yeah.
Get them up to about 30 or 40 years old, and now you know what they look like.
Yeah, we've perfected cloning technology. Missed a lot. No. So everyone who's watched a police procedural knows that crime scene investigators can link the tiniest bits of organic evidence to a perpetrator through their DNA. And a new technique could take DNA's crime-fighting potential a leap forward by leveraging it to create a 3D model of the suspect's face, as reported by researchers in the journal Advanced Science. Their computational tool, called DiffFace, D-I-F-F-A-C-E, looks for genetic differences between single letters of the genetic alphabet, known as single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. It then clusters related data points into what the researchers call 3D facial point clouds, essentially sets of data points that represent the exterior surface of a face. Researchers tested the method on a Han Chinese database with SNPs. They demonstrated that DiffFace could complete an accurate facial reconstruction based on DNA data. Adding information such as age, sex, and body mass index improved the quality of the 3D images. Some challenges still remain before the technique is perfected. For instance, identifying different characteristics is harder in people who are more genetically similar. According to the paper, it says, "Validating DiffFace with datasets from multiple ethnic groups and exploring whether additional genetic loci are necessary for certain facial features will be key steps to ensuring that the model generalizes effectively across diverse populations." The biggest challenges are the legal and ethical, not technical ones, though. Which, yeah.
correct.
It's a pretty short article. The thing about a lot of those crime procedurals is that they really over-exaggerate what the tech can do, including the DNA technology. And a lot of it is really up to interpretation, depending. I mean, DNA is pretty good, but, you know, even facial recognition algorithms are not that great.
DNA is not solid, too. It has sent innocent people to jail many, many times. And I see this happening here, too. And, you know, can it reconstruct 20 years of meth face?
Right.
Good question. Yeah.
Just look at one person and how different they look, even within a 3 or 4 year period when stuff's been happening in their lives and they got a new haircut. And they, you know, this, it almost feels like police sketch artists where it's like, oh, that is the most generic face ever. You could apply it to anyone.
Yep. And if they're brown, then all the better, because that's the blanket permission they need to do whatever they want.
Not only that, have you all seen the, like, it's like a picture of all the Supermans, like Henry Cavill, all the people who've played him, and they all look the same, or the Joey Deschanel's, and they all look the same too.
No, everybody's got multiple doppelgangers out there to begin with.
Right.
I feel like science is becoming less and less our friend, guys.
Well,
like, yeah, there's cuttlefish, but then there's also like facial recognition.
I mean, listen, which hermetic text was it where they're like, writing was a mistake? People are going to forget everything.
Yeah. That was actually Socrates. And Socrates, he hated Plato for writing down everything he said. He's like, you're ruining all of knowledge. And point, maybe.
I was going to blame Obama, but all right.
Thanks, Plato. Thanks, Plato. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Speaking of strange things, it's from Gizmodo. A strange, unexplained hum is keeping a Scottish Isle awake at night.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear. Uh-huh.
So the founder of the Hebridean Hum, Low Frequency Noise Disturbance Action and Support Group on Facebook. described it to BBC's Radio Good Morning Scotland's program as a very low humming, droning, pulsating noise. It's incredibly intrusive and distressing. She said the noise is making it hard to sleep and concentrate. I keep getting a lot of fluttering in my ears. It's making me dizzy and giving me headaches. So, in the Facebook post, Kirtley wrote that the group has made spectrograph recordings, and at each location where people heard the strange sounds, they identified a persistent, recordable 50 hertz signal of variable strength present in all locations, indicating that the hum isn't being produced from the center of the island, just kind of all over the place. Using this approach, they ruled out all known potential on-island sources, including ports, turbines, and other infrastructure. The group says it's reached out to various organizations for support, but there's still no widespread agreement on the possible cause. Kirtley, however, believes it's human and not natural, which it probably is. So, recent reports joined a host of other mysterious hums that have been reported around the world for decades. There's even the World Hum Map and Database Project, which was a clickable link founded by Hum Here Glenn McPherson, a former University of British Columbia lecturer. According to the website, the hum is typically compared to a car or truck engine idling outside your home or down the block, a low rumbling or droning sound. It's often perceived louder at night than during the day and louder indoors than outdoors, which is also kind of weird. So the local council of the Isle of Lewis confirmed receiving reports from some islanders about low frequency sound and said the environmental health team is investigating the situation. So, you know, there's actually comments in this, and I went down and looked at a couple of them. And, you know, a few people are like, I've been hearing the same thing. And they're kind of in the same area. But one person brought up something that I thought was interesting, which was the frequencies might be lower than that. And what's happening is comb interference. So it's kind of what I talked about in one of our lessons, where it was that super high frequency sound that we could bend and make by combining two frequencies to create one frequency. And that might be what's going on here, too. So it might be like 20 hertz or 15 hertz, really loud, that's vibrating.
So what you're telling me is that the octopi have had enough and they're trying to signal their intergalactic brethren to just, come on, we need reinforcements.
Yeah, or The Abyss was actually a documentary.
I hope so. The Abyss was a fun movie. I wouldn't mind that.
It was a good movie, agreed.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include: this century-old chair tells a story long buried, could the English language die, and scientists create ultra-rare hydrogen-6 isotope. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInterestingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.